closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm Todd Conklin, your host for today, and probably the next one, and maybe the one after that, and maybe the one after that. So today's kind of a big day, because today we're going to go and talk the second part of the conversation I had with Bob Edwards. And this part of the conversation is probably the most interesting part of the conversation. The first interview was great. I mean, the first conversation was amazing, so I'm not dogging it. But this one, Bob specifically talks about sort of his forte in safety too, and that is operational learning. And specifically what he talks about is creating these learning teams. And he's done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And he'll talk about that. In fact, what he's going to talk about is how empowering and engaging it is to bring workers in early on in problem identification, problem discovery, and problem solution. And he talks about all three quite differently. I'll let him explain that as we proceed on through the podcast. It's been a good week for me, back from a big international trip and actually getting ready to go on another one. I've got to swoop up north this week and hang out with my Canadian brethren, but that'll be fun as well. And spring is in the air. Santa Fe is looking amazing. The airports are crazy, and now we've switched from snow and ice to thunderstorms, and holy crap, are we getting some thunderstorms. That's been remarkable as well. Other than that, all is well. Life is good, and I hope yours is as well. Lots of interesting conversations on upcoming podcasts that I'm sure you'll want to hear lots more about. A bunch of people have requested, certainly shown interest in being a part of these podcasts, and that is great. If you think you've got something to say, I'd love to hear from you as well. It would be even better if you were a part of this conversation. But for now, let's delay not much longer, and let's talk to Bob Edwards, and he's going to talk about learning teams. If you don't know about these, you're going to want to know about these, because this is a remarkable way to actually put some wheels on the new view. This is probably one of the initial, first, most powerful, and most empowering first steps you can do in moving your organization to the new view, and they work great. So without any further ado, listen carefully, because the audio is a bit soft on this one, so you'll have to test your hearing, but I'll see if I can pump it up. Here is Bob Edwards and Learning Teams.
That's how that works. So hopcoach.net,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
Hopcoach.net. Okay, that sounds good. All right, so now we get to talk about learning teams. So we talked a little bit about your background in theory last time. Now let's talk about the process of learning teams. Because to a great extent, you've really developed a ton of this stuff. And because you've done it a bunch of times with a bunch of different companies. I mean, you've worked with lots of different companies besides GE. Although GE is like working in lots of different companies.
Right.
But what's the process? Pretend that I don't know what the crap I'm doing, which is almost always accurate with me, and tell me what I would do. Because last week you talked a little bit about starting sort of in the process and working towards the problem. You know, that's very contrary to what safety people will have been taught or have thought. I mean, we almost always start at the problem and then seek from the problem, you know, backwards. We seek out into the process. So take us through. Start where you think we should start.
Okay.
And then, you know, I guess end where you think we should end. And then the middle should somewhere find its own way. So we should make it through this. We'll live. I promise. Go.
Yeah. So when we think about this notion of operational learning or a learning team, it takes a little bit of time. Not a lot of time, but it does. If you bring the right people together, So I say this from the beginning, we don't do learning teams for everything, but we do select meaningful events or near misses or good catches or operational upsets. We're like, you know, let's not just do our traditional root cause approach here. Let's really try to understand this at a deeper level. When I talk about flipping it around, here's what I used to do. I used five whys a lot back in the day. Well, what, 4 years ago.
Okay.
So Five Wise.
A lot of people that are listening to this are in love with Five Wise.
I was too. It was perfect.
And they think that Five Wise is really, you know, it really drives you deeper into the problem.
Because you ask why five times. Yeah, you're getting going until you get to the root cause.
Right,
and,
right.
And what it caused me to do was think super linear, sort of like there was this direct path to failure. And I think what I saw as cause and effect maybe was more of I see an effect and I find a cause. It was almost kind of backwards.
Ah. Right?
And so then I would get to what I thought was the root cause. I would fix that and I think everything's good to go. Well, now I'm realizing I'm not trying to pick on Five Whys, but I just think it's too narrow. I think there's way more to the story in almost all cases. So now if, instead of starting at the event looking backwards, which a lot of times ended up with a worker failing to follow procedure and things like that, if I flip the equation around and I say, let's just start back in the process. How did your day start? When did we put this piece of equipment in? Or when did we change the workstation? It's not the same for every event. So some event has happened. Maybe it's a near miss. If we start back in the process and I ask the guys that are close to the work, hey, just tell me about your work. First of all, I'm not worried about collusion. I'm not worried that they're all going to get together and tell me the same exact story because I'm not looking for somebody to blame. And I tell them that pretty early on, hey, this isn't a traditional investigation. This is about learning. I want you guys to teach me about your work. People are actually pretty interested in telling you about their work. People kind of, even if they complain, you know, you get these guys, I've been here 20 years, can't stand it here. Well, you've been here 20 years, so you must be able to kind of stand it, right? But people like, right?
There's something you're standing.
Right. And so people actually like to talk about their work and their challenges and the things that they face. And so as a coach for this, I call myself kind of a hop coach. As I coach these learning sessions, if I start back in their day or start back in their process to when we say it was some kind of equipment related type thing or whatever, when do we put that piece of equipment in and kind of start the conversation there, as they start telling me about their work, about other near misses, about just issues that they have out there, sort of normal stuff that happens day in and day out, I'm starting to get a much clearer picture of just really how complex their work is. And then you'll see hazards and risks in there, but what's interesting to me is as they start to unlock this story and we start moving towards the event, the more we talk about all the things that they deal with, literally, to me anyway, by the time we get to the discussion of the actual event, it's not even a surprise that the event happened.
Now that you're really into this learning stuff, has your definition of near miss changed?
Let me think.
Mine has a ton.
Yeah, so for me, a near miss is almost like a gift.
Now. Oh, I completely agree with that. And it's the event without the failure.
So
but let me challenge you.
Okay.
I don't think we see lots of... Well, so first of all, I think the idea of near miss is kind of a goofy name. And it's probably closer to... It's really probably a safeguard test.
Right.
So we're testing our safeguards. We're testing our process. We're testing our defenses. But I'll let near miss go. I mean, I don't think that's worth the battle. I wonder how many predictive near misses we have versus how many events we have where our systems actually stop the event before the consequence happened. So a crane drop. So you're lifting a load, overhead crane. You've got a really good culture that nobody stands under the load. And you've really built that culture. You've maintained it. People believe it. They barricade. They put lights up. They do all that kind of stuff. Something drops. It doesn't hit anybody. Is that an event? Is that a near miss? Or is that a success?
Yeah, so in my mind, now that's becoming more of a success. If I've got defenses in place that nobody got hurt when something potentially catastrophic.
Well, it's a crane drop, for God's sakes. Yeah. How much more potentially catastrophic do you need than a crane drop?
If nobody gets hurt from that, I might still call it a near miss, but it's a pretty... It's successful if nobody got hurt. Because to me, the most important thing is, you know, people not getting hurt. But I also don't want equipment being damaged because that hurts the business.
Oh, absolutely. No, right? I agree. But if you treat it as a near miss and do an investigation, mm-hmm. which is what we do, because it's a gift, right? It's the event without the consequence. Then you're actually going to probably, in a way, punish the worker mm-hmm. for something that didn't happen but could have.
Mm-hmm.
if you treat it as a success, our defenses worked, our safeguards actually. We tested our safeguards. We definitely tested our policy on no one stands under the load, and we passed.
Right.
Then does the learning, is the learning different there? I hate to interrupt you with this, but no, I'm really fixated on this because I think as an organization gets safer, their near-miss numbers get smaller and less predictive. So now you have near misses that aren't predictive. You have near misses that are anomalous. They're freaks. They're crazy crap that's never happened before. Right. And we're so safe and our culture is so strong that when it did happen, it didn't hurt us. I don't know. It's just something to think about.
Well, I know that, that ties in also with this notion of good catch, which is, I think, a little further upstream. So it's maybe even before the quote-unquote near miss happened.
Well, it's more preventive, right? Yeah. So I hate the word proactive. Hate it. Hate it. Hate it. First of all, I think it's made up, and it's way jargony.
Right.
What we do is prevent the seriousness and frequency of events. That's what we do. And to prevent, we have to live on the front end of the equation. We have to live in the context of the event, not in the consequence of the event.
Right.
And I think near miss force functions us to think consequence, when in fact a near hit or a good catch or a safeguards test, whatever you want to call it, and I haven't figured out that yet, but whatever you want to call it, that forces us into the context. I mean, it seems like there's better learning if you see it as a success, but I don't know.
Well, I know we're starting to treat things like good catches and near misses more along the lines of, hey, look at all the things that did work. We still want to get better. We want to definitely learn from it. But I agree with you. If we treat it like an investigation, it just automatically has that sort of negative feel to it, for sure. So where were we at? We were back.
Well, you're sort of walking us through the process of the learning team.
Right. So when we're doing this operational learning around some event, perhaps, or even just around a concern, if we're talking back in the process of all the stuff that they're dealing with, and getting the conversation more open, you know, you could question and say, well, are you going to go too wide? Will it become world hunger that you're trying to solve? Well, as a coach, your job is to kind of coach and ask questions and keep it somewhat contained, but also don't contain it so much that you don't listen to other things. I can tell you this. I used to do this. Someone would bring up some things that were out of scope, and I'd say, I'll put that on the parking lot. I'll write that down. It'll be on the parking lot. I don't remember having any parking lot meetings to talk about all the stuff that goes in the park. Right? Now I'm like, well, tell me about it. You've had other near misses out there? Tell me about them. We all know that near misses happen that don't get reported.
Oh, of course,
time.
Of course.
So now,
well, and sometimes they don't get reported. Sometimes you don't even know it's a near miss,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I
exactly.
mean, you don't know. It's not that you're hiding information from management.
Right.
You just don't even know.
It's just
you don't know that you almost died or almost hurt yourself.
Yeah, and so now we're getting a more open conversation. So when people bring these things up, what's interesting to me is sometimes we'll surface some things that may even need more attention than the event or near miss that happened that brought us together to begin with. So here's another thing that I see that happens as we talk about all this stuff, production pressure and flawed assumptions and system weaknesses and system strengths and things that worked well and things that didn't work. And we just really open this conversation up. It gives us a much more holistic look at what this whole event, you know, what it took for this whole event to come together and to actually happen. So now, as you're explaining that story, so I use flip charts when I do this. So as people are teaching me and I'm learning, it's not any kind of a legal thing. I'm not like writing down, well, then Todd told me this, and then Bill said this, and then Sam. I don't even write down people's names. They just are teaching me about their work. I'm writing it down, validating what they're teaching me. In the first session, so I do this, you taught this to me, but the first session was about an hour long with the guys close to the event that really know the work, and I'm just in learning mode. I don't let them solve anything. Now, you may say, well, that's silly because aren't you coming together to fix stuff? Well, not yet. Matter of fact, we've already propped it up, so it's not leaking anymore or whatever. We fix that immediately. We do that just naturally. Now I want to learn, and I want to be deliberate about learning. So I don't let them. You could bring me the cure for cancer in that first session, and I won't write it down. Right? I'm gonna bring it back tomorrow. We'll talk about it. But right now, I want to just keep us in learning mode. And what I find, and as I teach people how to do this, other coaches, they're like, okay, we'll do that. And then they'll come back to me later and go, that was harder than I thought. Because even the workers that come into the session, they'll come in saying things like, oh, I know what we need to do. well, wait, hold on, not yet. Let's make sure we learn. So we take a first session of about an hour long, totally in learning mode.
Why only an hour? Is that enough, too much, too little?
So occasionally it takes a little longer. Sometimes it takes 45 minutes. But as a coach, you kind of get a feel for, I mean, for one thing, my hand gets tired for writing. Right?
Yeah. Flip chart.
But in reality, an hour is actually a pretty good amount of time if you have people close to the work and close to the event. They can teach you a ton of stuff in an hour. And then we give them soak time, right? And I don't know where you originally came up with that, but it's brilliant. I mean, it is. Soak time is that notion of let your brain kind of work this stuff out. So we try to do it overnight at least. If you can't, like if it's a place where you can only bring the workers together to look at this event today, and so we'll give them the lunch period. But really it works best if you give them overnight. I don't let it go too far, but give them overnight. Then bring them back together in that next session for 1 hour again or thereabouts. And start it. Here's how I start out the second session. I start it with a little review. I have the flip charts up on the wall. I'm like, okay, guys, this is what you taught me yesterday, or you know, when we were together last. As I explain it back to them, it does a couple of things. First of all, it validates that what they said to me was meaningful. It also shows whether I listened good, because if I don't get something right, they'll tell me, no, that's not what we meant by that. What we were saying is, so I make some corrections if needed. And then it still keeps us in learning mode. Now, I've done hundreds of these, so I can tell you this has never failed me. I'll ask them this question. After I've done a little review, I'll say, did anybody think of anything else since yesterday? Never fails me. At least one person will say, you know, I was driving home and I thought about, or I remembered that we also, and when they do that, you know what just happens with our operational intelligence? It just got deeper.
Well, it's I'm always smarter after I leave the meeting,
mm-hmm.
because I always think of all the stuff I should have said
right.
when they ask the question in the meeting. So, I totally agree.
And now it gives them a chance to bring that back.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
And our folks, our good friends in Hungary, when we did some of this learning team training over there, remember they taught us the soak time, their phrase is Ula Padesh.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah,
the settling of the waters.
Ula Padesh. Ula Padesh.
At least that's what they told us it means.
It probably means something totally different. Right. Okay, so you've done session one.
Yep. We've had soak time.
All discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a little break to allow people to sort of think about what they've talked about.
Right.
Okay, then what happens?
So then we bring them back in this second session, like I was talking about. We start back out in learning mode. So we write down anything else. Now, I've done a bunch of these around a bunch of different kind of events. In most cases, it only takes a few sessions to really kind of unlock the story. And then what I love to do is, hey, tell me about the stuff that worked well. Like we were just talking about a minute ago, really.
Right.
Like what kind of things, you know, sometimes they'll say, well, nothing worked well. Well, we didn't, you know, blow the place up, so something worked well.
Right.
So
something's working.
Yeah, that's right. Get them to talk about that so they can start to realize, okay, there are things in place that did help contain this to keep it from getting worse. And then this is, as an engineer, the fun part for me is then I say, okay, what do you guys want to do different? What are your ideas and thoughts? And that's when we start getting into all the, you know, like brainstorming ideas. I write down all their ideas. And, I mean, even crazy ones that seem like they would never work or whatever. It's okay. I'm writing all this stuff down. And this is usually in the second or maybe third session. But usually it doesn't take more than two or three learning sessions to deal with most events. Now, we've had some that were really, really complex where we stayed in learning mode several sessions just because we really had to unlock a complex, long-term kind of an issue. Then, as they help come up with all these ideas, and I shouldn't say help, because really they come up with all these cool ideas. As an engineer, I like to listen for the things that I think might be the stronger defenses and encourage them to talk more about that. But in reality, they do come up with the best defenses ever in most cases. I'm writing all this stuff down.
Are they expensive? Are they world? You know, giant change, you know, redesign the entire plant.
Right.
Dig a hole, that kind of stuff.
So I can tell you in most cases, they're a much lower cost than what I would have come up with. I had a quality one we were doing at a site, and my solution would have been about a $50,000 rebuild of the test equipment. They came up with this little test box that could do tests for this fan motor working, which was like less than $50.
Wow.
Wow,
and that's so amazing.
The problem was is that I had already told them what my idea was, and then when they came up with their idea, I was like, oh, never mind about the $50,000 solution. I was just testing you guys. And so, but the reality is the more I listen to them and listen to their ideas, you know, and there's a whole field of study around human factors. But what's cool is a lot of the stuff they come up with actually fits in with this notion of it, let's make it easier to do right than to do wrong. And they come up with this because they're close to it and they have to deal with it every day. And so here we have this list of these ideas that they have. And then we know we can't do everything. So as a coach, I talk the team through this notion of sort of ease of implementation and prioritizing stuff.
Right, right.
And we have a real simple way. You may say, well, Bob, that's just too simple. But it's one star, two star, three star. I mean, one star things are just go-dos. Some of them may not even be super impactful, but they're easy to do. They'll make it a little better. So, like, let's just go ahead and do that, you know. File the sharp edge off of that or put, something, some tape down the ergo mat. I mean, you know, maybe it's not super impactful, but it's easy go-dos. So we built a little bit of confidence that, yeah, we can actually make things better. And then like a one-star thing type items are really easy to go do and may or may not be super impactful, but they'll have some kind of impact. And then two-star, maybe we have to get maintenance to help us or we got to get a PO cut to, you know, so it's a little more involved. And then a three-star thing, it may or may not be able to do that anytime soon, but sort of help them manage. Really, you and I have done a lot of project management through our career.
Right.
Well, now we're taking a team of workers that are normally just doing their work and helping them become a little, I shouldn't say little, I mean, they're becoming a project management team.
Oh, yeah, full blown.
Prioritize, right, and figure out what they can do. And what's really interesting to me is if they come up with a solution, and maybe it does cost a little bit of money, I have a really compelling, I can show the air trap that they identified. I can show the issues and concerns that they have. I can show the solution set that they came up with. So as a coach, I can be their advocate and say, here's what the team really wants to do, and here's how much it'll cost. I stand a better chance of actually getting the funding than if I just say, oh yeah, for example, for crane safety, I need $30,000 to make things better. Well, generally speaking, you know, they review the budget and they give me $15,000, right? They cut it in half and give it back. So, but now I'm not just asking for some plug number. I have really good, compelling data and a really compelling story to ask for some funding to help with the solution set.
What's the work product look like? What's the outcome look like? Is it a form? Is it a web page? Is it, I don't know, a report?
So it's different. It's different. So we have created different ways of kind of presenting what the team has done. I think it's really, you taught me this too early on, you got to tell the stories.
Right. So it's about the story, yeah, for sure.
Really important piece of this and a really important product is the story of how the team unlocked this complex issue, how they tried things out and brainstormed, and we call it tri-storming, where you try things and experiment around. I think maybe Sidney Decker calls it micro-experimentation.
He does. Isn't that a great word?
A cool word, yeah. Cool phrase.
Micro-experimentation. Yes.
And so we're teaching them how to become sort of experimenters and trying things out. And so we want to tell that story and show the defenses that they put in place and show that they went way beyond sort of some of our typical counseled and retrained employee kind of solutions that we've seen a lot of in our careers, right? So we want to tell those stories. And then the actual product that makes that particular event better is the solutions that they put in place. You know, standardized remote controls for cranes or whatever, a better way of parking knuckle booms, better traffic flow through an intersection. I mean, the work product is the solution set.
And the workers have to have that voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause what I see, and you tell me if I'm wrong on this, but when they first start doing learning teams, they include workers. But quite honestly, the hardest person to have access to time for in the entire facility is the hourly guy out on the production line.
Yep.
You know, the guy out in the field.
Yep.
They're the hardest person to pull off the line. And so what happens is, I've seen this happen over and over again, where they'll stop using workers and they'll still do learning teams, but they'll be all admin people,
right,
that you can walk down the hallway and get three engineers and two safety guys and a supervisor, stick them in a room and say, solve the problem. Why doesn't that work?
Well, so people have even asked me that. Where have you seen this not work well? And one of the sites that struggled with this a lot was doing that. They would bring their sort of leaders and managers together and maybe bring in one employee. I mean, think about that. You got five or six managers and one employee, and you're going to solve a problem that's an operational problem.
Oh, the sad thing is it happens all the time.
Right, right.
And they think, it kind of pisses me off, too, because they think they're doing it right, and they think that they're giving the employee sort of their just voice. Right. I mean, in a way, Bob, what you do really well is give the voice back to the worker. And so the worker has representation in problem identification, problem discovery, and problem solution. I mean, so if they're not in the room, or if there's only one in the room and they're incredibly outnumbered by management, they don't have a voice. Right. I mean, they didn't get that voice.
Right. And you and I actually went through one of these where that we were with the quote-unquote learning team, which was all managers and one employee.
Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, and they said, manager was like, it's much bad. We got it fixed.
Problem is solved. This is a non-starter now. This is not a problem.
And so we asked them, could we restructure the learning team and bring a bunch of the workers close to this environment that we, you know, this learning team was about? And the next session we had was with them, and they said, no, it's horrible. It's not as horrible as it used to be, but it's still horrible. And so it was a real eye-opener for that site. And so that's why, you know, we talked earlier about the need for leadership to understand this. Yeah, the leadership has to understand that this is maybe giving up a little bit of what we perceive as our control. It's perceived, I think, more than anything else. But giving up some control to the guys that actually do the work, letting them sort through this and help us come up with a solution set, and then empowering them to make it happen.
The irony is it actually makes it easier for managers.
It's way better for me because they come up with better solutions, and they own it. So think about this. We had a traffic flow problem on one of our lines. We had tried for a couple of years off and on with our traditional sort of industrial engineering kind of approach and lean approach to these things, and we tried to solve it. We couldn't seem to make it much better, and we pulled together a learning team comprised of the guys that drive and deliver parts and work the workstations out there. And I mean, in 2 1-hour learning sessions, and then we did we have these like Kaizen weeks or continuous improvement weeks. So
right,
we gave
right,
them
right.
this little group of five or six people. We gave them a week to do what we call tri-storming, which is that micro experimentation,
right,
trying
right.
it out. And in a week of tri-storming, after these 2 days of learning, or two hours of just learning, then they went out there and did a bunch of more learning and trying and learning and trying, and they built a bus route system out there that was amazing. They solved it in, I think, less time than what we had committed to try to solve it before, when we really hadn't solved it. So it takes management to understand that it will take a little bit of committed time, but I think, you and I have had this discussion, I think overall it takes less overall time if you bring the right people together, empower them, encourage them, give them some confidence that they can actually do this, and let them solve it.
And it's cheaper. And it's better.
Yeah,
and it engages workers.
Yep.
It's more sustainable.
Yep.
And it actually is easier on your schedule as a manager.
Yes.
Okay, so then the question that's being begged to ask right now is, why aren't everyone doing these? Why aren't these everywhere? Why does this feel like a new idea to people? It drives me crazy.
I think it's just because a lot of what we've done in the past made sense. I mean, if I'm a manager and I'm paid to be a manager, I think I'm paid to make decisions.
Yeah, don't you think it's Taylorism? Don't you think it's that fundamentally, and this should really drive people crazy, but fundamentally, don't you think it's the fact that we believe managers are smarter than workers,
yeah.
or workers are defective managers or something somehow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of culturally where we're at across the globe.
It certainly is true in Western organizations.
Yeah, so the planner's smarter than the worker, but it's just simply not true. Now, the planner knows stuff that the worker doesn't know, but the guy that does the work also knows stuff that the planner doesn't know.
Right, that's fair.
So I think what we're seeing with this is that we need to break this notion of, and we call it Taylorism, right?
Yeah,
it is. Sorry to Frederick Taylor, but he kind of kicked us off.
Yeah,
so.
It's his fault.
That's right.
He's dead, so he doesn't care.
So,
and he never listens to podcasts.
Right, right.
Never.
And so when we break this notion that the planner's smarter than the worker, and we realize, hey, we'll actually have better work if we have the guys close to it help us develop the plan. I mean, I've seen better procedures written. The best lockout tagout I've ever seen was written by the maintenance guys and the fab techs that actually do this stuff. Now, I helped lay it out in a nice format, so don't get rid of me. You still need me. right? You need my nice PowerPoint skills to put it together, right?
Yeah, exactly. But
the actual data that went in this thing came from the guys really close to it, and it's the best I've ever seen. And then what's really cool about this, Todd, is that the more we're doing this, we're realizing this isn't a safety thing. This helps with quality. I mean, dimming taught us a lot of this kind of stuff too, but it really helps us get more traction with what we want to do with quality, helps us with lean events, helps us with when operational upsets happen. And what I love as a design engineer for a decade, I love carrying this conversation to the design guys and saying, listen, if we truly engage the guys that have to install, maintain, and operate this stuff in the design, the design's going to look different.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and we've actually done some of those and starting to see, wow, when you realize as an engineer, you simply don't know what an operator is going to know that has to run this thing all day long. And I don't mean go out and get his complaint list. You know, we say, oh yeah, I got the operator's input. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I need you as an operator to help me think this through. Where should gauges be? How should buttons work? How should the system respond? Help me think this through. I can go put it together as an engineer, but I need your ideas on how to really make that interface much, much better.
So let's recap. So you come together for the first time, mm-hmm. only in discovery. You soak time.
Yep.
You come back and look at what works and what doesn't work. Solve problems. Prioritize. Then what else?
Tell those stories.
Tell
follow
the story.
And follow up. Make sure you follow up. So I try to not add in any more bureaucracy. Maybe the organizations out here that might be listening to this don't have enough bureaucracy, so I can share some with them, right?
Yeah, that is the problem. Yeah, most organizations don't have enough
bureaucracy here. So I try to not add in. I recommend use the systems that are there, like a P&A list or team P&A list or work order systems or audit tracking systems or whatever you have that's already there to help to track the actions. It's because you need to make sure things get done. You know, people own it and whatever. Now, here as a coach, I'll tell you a challenge that I have. It's easy, especially at sites that I work at a lot, that people know me and the fact that I was a maintenance leader and all that. It's easy for me to get on the phone and fix it. And so I have to restrain myself there and say, it may take a little bit more time, but if I can coach the team to coordinate with maintenance to get the thing done or whatever, the team becomes more empowered and they're not dependent upon me. You know, because I mean, I could get hit by a truck or win the lottery or whatever and not show up tomorrow. And so I need them to, by the way, I don't play the lottery because I don't have any money to get.
And your luck would be you'd win the lottery, then get hit by a truck.
Exactly. And so, but that I don't want them to need me. I like for people to want me, but I don't want them to need me, right? So I need these guys to really get confident that they can actually coordinate with each other. I worked at a site that was struggling to get a really simple task done. I got to tell you, I just wanted to jump in and do it and just take care of it. I refused to do it. In my mind, I just said, I've got to not do it. My job as a coach is to help them actually accomplish this seemingly simple task. But they had a lot of problems with getting along. And so this helped them work through that.
That's
so
good.
This is kind of a psychology
piece. Could you go into a company and help them do one of these and teach them?
I love doing that. That's what I love. That's what I do. So, so it's important that they have the fundamentals because we need to think about how we're thinking.
Right.
We need to kind of challenge that a little bit and see if we can frame up how we want to think about this stuff, failures and near misses and all these things. And then pretty quickly in, let's do one. And for me, I don't even care what it is. It could be a quality event. It could be a near miss. It could be a safety event. It could be an employee concern. Let's pick something. And let's do this operational learning with the guys close to the work, get their thoughts about how to make this better and let them try to really help us make this better and then just see if it actually works.
How do they contact you?
Hopcoach.net. That's me. Hopcoach.net. Yeah, so it's H-O-P coach, all one word, .net. And my contact information is there. And my schedule's on there too. And I try to keep it fairly accurate, but it gives you kind of an idea when there's some openings in my schedule. And love to come help people out getting this going. And remember, the goal is to build in the capacity at the site so that they don't need me anymore. They can just get this going and carry it forward. So we really do look for people that want to be coaches, that want to get on board, and they'll co-coach, if you will. They'll be right there with me, and I'll show them how we do this. But I'm also learning and listening from them, because we may figure out some ways to do it even better as we move forward. Probably will, right?
You think we got it?
I think that covers the basics.
So was your second podcast easier than your first podcast?
I was a whole lot less nervous.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
I wasn't shaking as much.
Did we miss anything?
No, we had that great breakfast burrito this morning, so everything's good to go.
Yeah, that is good. So. That's good to go. And it'll be good to go later, too. That's how this works. All right, man. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having
later.
Me,
God. Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Made it through another one. What'd you think? These learning teams are amazingly interesting and really powerful. We started them a long time ago in my old shop, and I've used them all over the world. Bob has kind of taken them to the next level, and he's really had some benefits from them. Actually, his organizations that he's working with has really had some benefits. And the surprising thing is the results you learn are almost never the results you go in to learn. And there are really some interesting discoveries. And learning's pretty messy. And that's okay. Learning can be messy because it's important. We try to keep the learning process simple because the answers oftentimes are somewhat complicated. So you've got a messy process that involves learning, discovering, and fixing, and it sort of moves on from there. That's the podcast. I hope you like it. We can certainly do more with Bob. He's always available. He's someone you ought to think about talking to for your company, too. He's really an interesting cat. That's for sure. This has been fun, and as always, I can't thank you enough for listening. The numbers are just remarkable. I mean, it's so much more than I imagined it would be, and it's pretty fun to do these for you. The discipline it takes is I'm learning some new skills here, that's for sure. As always, learn something every day, have a great time, and for goodness sakes, be safe.